Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people, the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. What do you want to say? I mean, these silly buggers. Here's a news story, Dateline Tehran. A stampede broke out Tuesday at a funeral for a top Iranian general killed in a U.S. airstrike, and at least 56 people were killed and more than 200 injured as thousands thronged the procession, the Iranian news report said. The stampede took place in Kerman, and that's the hometown of the Revolutionary Guard, General Qasem Soleimani. As the procession began, according to the semi-official Fars and ISNA news agencies, and they were citing the head of Iran's emergency services. You've got to wonder, right? 56 people killed in a stampede. Yeah, there's a difference between the First World and the Third World, isn't there? And they just can't organize. Well, picking up rumors about this, and this is extreme, very, as a matter of fact, quite distressing. Already, in late 2019 and January thus far, millions of acres on the eastern coast of Australia have been incinerated in dreadful forest fires. That's bad, of course. But Alex Jones and others are reporting that the police have arrested and charged 183 people thus far with deliberately setting fires. Now, that's a lot. Deliberately is different from accidentally. It's accidentally you would be you're outdoors and using a blowtorch and sparks accidentally accidentally light something up, so these fires are really serious, and apparently 183 people have so far been arrested for setting fires. And that's deliberately. Now, that's quite different from accidentally. And it's strongly believed that some of these people are doing it in order to create more pressure on the global warming climate change side of the debate. In other words, you cause this terrible destructive phenomenon, and then claim it's climate change, so we have to adopt, you know, the usual carbon tax radical anti-progress policies. You know, you create the problem and then step forward with the solution. One of the most fascinating things that's come our way in a long time comes on the so-called anti-racist front. And it's an affidavit filed by a person named Elise Hadigan. And Elise Hadigan is a longtime anti-racist, highly unstable person. She joined the Heritage Front back in the early 1990s, as I believe she was a 16-year-old girl. And Elise, I think, was in over her head. She was a deeply troubled girl, as I knew her only slightly back then, but others who knew her better knew that she came from a very troubled background. Her parents were recent immigrants from Romania. The father did not like Canada, did not like her, did not like even living here. The father was abusive, so she ended up living in welfare housing with her mother. Her mother was also abusive, and a young, I believe she was 16, Elise gravitated toward the White Nationalist Heritage Front, and she was quite an eager recruit. And I met her, I believe, twice, and Ernst Zundel had warned the leader of the Heritage Front, Wolfgang Drogen, to beware of her, to drop her. He said, "This girl is disturbed. She'll end up hurting you." Well, she did in the end. The only time I had any real dealings with Elise was, I'm going to say it was early in 1992. Ernst Zundel had appealed his conviction under Canada's eventually discredited and law, the false news law, which would eventually be ruled unconstitutional by the court. And anyway, I believe the appeal was to be made to the Supreme Court. And on the eve of the appeal, he had to turn himself in to the authorities. You see, you're on leave pending appeal. I'm sorry, you're on bail pending appeal. So he turned himself in, and he was kept at what was then the Toronto Don Jail. It was a horrible place, but anyway, he would be kept in, I think, overnight. So a number of us in the Canadian Association for Free Expression and other Zundel supporters had a protest. Free Ernst Zundel and so on, just to draw attention to the free speech issues. And Elise was in that protest. She's not a member of our group, but she did attend. And I happened to be walking beside her with a sign. And a Negro woman and a small child, whom I would guess would be about 3, walked up the stairs to go in, I guess, to visit the child's father. And Elise turned to me and said, "I'd like to smash that child. I'd like to crush him. I'd like to break every bone in his body, crush his skull against the concrete." Now, I've had people, talk radically or big to me over the years now and again, and usually it's a guy trying to show off, and usually it's generalized expressions of desire to commit violence. This was immensely twisted and very specific, and I thought, I don't want these people in my country, and I don't want them in as immigrants, and they should be removed. Yes, but smashing, killing, and a 3-year-old child. No, I mean, ideally, we just deport them. But there was a vehemence, a twistedness to this. And I really was not in any way close to her, so she didn't even have, there wasn't even an excuse to try to impress me or something. I always remember that. Well, not very long afterwards, she got caught up by the police for a role in, I believe, distributing some fairly hardcore posters. She got scared. She turned Crown evidence, that's state's evidence, and she ratted out 3 of the members of the Heritage Front, including its their leader, Wolfgang Droege. And this was not the only thing in 1994 that led to the eventual collapse of the Heritage Front, but it was one of several, and it was a key thing. It was quite a big setback. She then dropped out, and she became an anti-racist. And she even eventually wrote a book many years later called Race Traitor. Now, all this is back in 1994. You know, flash forward 25, 26 years. But she and several others have been living off the, I left the Heritage Front and I'm an anti-racist. She so over the years, we would hear the odd thing about Elise Hattigan. She eventually apparently became a Jewess. It's hard to know exactly. Many people believe that she was actually not Romanian, but a gypsy. She apparently somehow discovered she had Jewish heritage, and she's become a Jewess. She's also decided that she's not a heterosexual, she's a lesbian, and she now has a lesbian lover who is described as of Afro-Caribbean origin, in other words, black. Honestly, you can't make this stuff up. You can't. Okay, we say, okay, that all sounds like the stories of yesteryear. What does this have to do with an affidavit and today? Well, that's a good question. Well, anyway, Elise Hattigan is suing Bernie Farber. Now, Bernie Farber was a former chief executive officer of the Canadian Jewish Congress. He's bounced around from several organizations since it essentially closed shop. He is now a director of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. Okay. Now, Elizabeth Moore, who's also being sued, was also a member of the Heritage Front, briefly. She came to the Heritage Front very disillusioned. She'd grown up in Scarborough area, and she said that the majority of her classmates were not white, and she began to feel I'm a stranger in my own country. She was middle class. She was at university at the time, and she joined the Heritage Front. I believe she was in perhaps for about a year. She was at university. She may have been influenced by others. She got cold feet or whatever, but she approached one of the arch enemies of the Heritage Front, the person who was then the head of the Canadian Jewish Congress. Well, no, at that point, I don't think he was the head, but he was a big noise in the Canadian Jewish Congress, and that was Bernie Farber. So she approached him, and he helped her transition out of the Heritage Front, and she became an anti-racist. And she did lectures, speeches for the Canadian Jewish Congress and other anti-racist groups. She apparently was a consultant on several television programs about the far right, including one called, I will recall the name in a moment. Hearts of Hate, I guess it was called, which was a fictionalized version of a young woman involved with a far right group, and how she eventually saw the error of things she experienced, saw the error of her ways, and converted. That's roughly it. Okay. So here, these are the basic personalities. So what's Elise Hattigan suing about? Well, I've gone through her affidavit, which has 300 numbered paragraphs. Actually, some numbers, actually, more than one paragraph. But anyways, it's quite extensive. And much of it has to do with this. She says that details that Elizabeth Moore used in some of her presentations, or that various media outlets have used and attributed to the person of Elizabeth Moore or to somebody based on Elizabeth Moore, were actually adventures or things that she had done and said, and she's not being given proper credit for it. And she and Elizabeth Moore has gotten more public recognition, has done speeches for various Jewish groups, and apparently gotten some money along the way. And basically, she's accusing Bernie Farber, who's sort of the Svengali now managing Elizabeth Moore, and Elizabeth Moore of having, I guess, appropriated her story or parts of it, and money that should have gone to her, Elise, and so on. Now, I am no legal expert, so I have no idea whether this claim has any merit at all. My guess is it probably doesn't, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. Which traitor to the cause gets credit for telling their story? It's probably not a great deal of interest to you or me. But this is a very, very long affidavit. And one of the things I find so fascinating in it is what it reveals about the inner workings of the anti-racist movement. And one of the key things we get to learn is about a man by the name of Kurt Phillips. Now, for years, going back about 10 years, we have had to put up with the rantings and ravings and troublemaking and personal exposés and that type of thing of an outfit called the ARC, or Anti-Racist Canada. And they have a blog spot. ARC, Anti-Racist Canada, has a blog, and they regularly put up radical, in some cases defamatory, statements against nationalists of all sorts. They published intimate pictures of people. They've made defamatory statements. They doxed people, caused a lot of people a lot of trouble. And along the way, many times, people have said, and I've certainly wanted to say, okay, why don't we sue them? Or why don't we actually make a criminal complaint? Because intimate photos cannot be published without the permission of the two parties, right? That's the way the matter stood. But they were, of course, the ARC, or Anti-Racist Canada, was extremely cagey about who was behind it. Well, I'll go further than cagey. This was highly suppressed information. For good reasons. Because they would be opening themselves up to very considerable litigation. We are told who is behind the ARC, the Anti-Racist Canada blog spot. And it is actually quite a rich story. And we have Elise Hadigan to thank for this. And I'm going to go over some of the material from the affidavit, because it's really quite intriguing. I'm going to start reading from paragraph 320 of the affidavit, and These are all the words of Elise Hadigan, and apparently they're true, or at least this much is true. She says, in 2011, I first became connected with the Anti-Racist Canada website by leaving a comment under a blog post. Soon I started a correspondence with the owner and operator of the website and Twitter account, Kurt Phillips, who operated under the anonymity of the ARC moniker. As soon as he saw my name, Kurt recognized me from my Heritage Front days. In an email dated June 19, 2012, he writes, when you first left that comment on the blog, I was excited because when I started studying and researching organized racism, you were a name I was intimately familiar with. You, more than anyone else, took down one of the nastiest hate groups that had existed in Canada in years, and you did this by rejecting a group that you'd been an active member of. You proved that people can change and do good, so I admit, when you first contacted us, I had a bit of a fanboy moment. As I learned more and more about you and how you struggled in the years between the mid-1990s and when you contacted me, I think my respect for you grew even more. Oh yeah, she spins a boo-hoo-hoo story about, you know, she was so afraid and she drifted from place to place and she lived for quite a while in poverty and. Well, yeah, she's like she left the Heritage Front with virtually no education and not much of work experience. This is Kurt Phillips, the person behind the ARC now writing to her. You did the right thing, knowing that it would put a mark on you, and you did this with no help at all from the government. Well, to betray your comrades. Anyway, they're all bitching and moaning about it. Hey, I was a traitor, but I didn't get paid. Okay, so this is all the head of the ARC. This that person whose name we now know, Kurt Phillips. And he says, you did all the right thing, knowing that it would put a mark on you and that you did this with no help at all from the government. At the same time, Bristow was given another identity, home, and a monthly paycheck. You were simply trying to make ends meet. You were given no advantage at all, and yet you did remarkable things. You received your high school diploma and was accepted to university graduation with honors. You've traveled and experienced life in ways most people have never dreamed of. You found love and made life for yourself. Oh, yeah, I guess I already mentioned she discovered she's a lesbian. That's an Afro-Caribbean lover. I say, you can't make this stuff up. You can't. Anyway, the reference to Bristow. Grant Bristow was a CSIS. That's the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. Government agent parachuted into a group of people who would become the Heritage Front. And it was one of the most clever, intelligence operation run by the Canadian government spy agency. Clever because it's one thing to infiltrate a group that's already created. And that can be somewhat difficult. It is better, though, if you can anticipate that a group of people are going to kind of coalesce into a group and already be there. You mean you've already got your cred or credibility. Now, the agent, Grant Bristow, joined the circle around somewhat has-been nationalist leader named Don Andrews in the East End of Toronto in 1989. Knowing, you see, or at least he may or may not have known, but his handlers knew that Wolfgang Droger was soon to be released from an American prison and would be deported back to Canada. And the Wolfgang had ambitions to form a group. So how better to join the group than to already apparently be accepted? Now, there's a circle of people who would gather at Don Andrews' place of a Sunday afternoon, and they would have a meal, and he would basically regale them with his latest ideas and theories. Well, Grant Bristow was a member of that, had been a member for a few months when Wolfgang Droger showed up. And Wolfgang, of course, was relatively young, younger than Andrews. and action-minded. He wanted to form something like the National Association of White People that David Duke had formed in the state. So more younger in image, younger in tone, playing skinhead music and things like that that would attract young people, and action-oriented. Whereas John Andrews and his group basically sat around and talked most of the time. So when Wolfgang showed up, several of the more activism-minded people in the Andrews Circle gravitated toward Wolfgang and helped form the Heritage Front. These included people like Max French and Jerry Lincoln, and of course Grant Bristow. So here's the government agent right inside the Heritage Front when it starts. He helped funnel money to the Heritage Front from the government. He would, on occasion, you know, if they were going up to Ottawa or Montreal, he said, well, you can come in my car, or I'll pick up the cost of the hotel. So he was well accepted and received. Now, there's a long story for Bristow, and I don't want to digress too much, but he was an agent provocateur. He wasn't just the silent ears, an agent to developing intelligence or information, is not supposed to participate in illegal activities, if any. But in Bristow's case, he deliberately urged illegal activities on a number of occasions. As I say, I don't want to go too far into that. But when he was exposed by the press in 1994, Bristow was given a new identity, ended up in a suburb of Edmonton, Alberta, and was on, at least we believe for a decade, a government pension. So he did pretty well out of doing what he did. Anyway, so back to comments made by Kurt Phillips. He's the head of the Anti-Racist Canada website, to Elise. And he concludes his letter to her: if you had just curled up into a ball and given up, I might not have blamed you. You were dealt a stacked deck, but you didn't give up. You never allowed any of the bastards to beat you. Well, we'll see about that. In my 4 years of friendship with Kurt Phillips and as part of the ARC collective, I supplied information such as names and photos of Heritage Front members, took photos and wrote several blog pieces that were posted on the ARC blog. I supported the website and Kurt's sleuthing activities by providing opinions and verbal written support where necessary. We advised and confided in each other on numerous occasions, both via email, telephone, and in person, and had conversations that reached far beyond the topic of racism and white supremacy. Kurt also sent me gifts and care packages on multiple occasions, so he helped out financially. I sent him one package in return, and he contributed financially to my book fundraising efforts, and that was her book, Race Traitor. My first post on Anti-Racist Canada appeared in November 2011. At that time, Kurt wrote in an email dated November 21st, 2011, that my material would be left permanently on the website. We also posted the link to your blog on Bristow, as well as your coming out post. The information to purchase your book is found at the top, and we're going to create a link on the site on the side so that it can be available permanently on the front page. So this is all helping Elise Hadigan promote her book, Race Traitor. Over the following months, Kurt and I became close friends. We started chatting over the phone, and at one point in 2013, he visited me in Toronto. Kurt became my best friend and someone I confided in frequently, including sharing my doubts and concerns about Elizabeth Moore's appropriation of my lived experiences. As an expert in the field of anti-racism in Canada and someone regularly relied on by reporters who cover stories about neo-fascism in Canada, such as even Belgord, Kurt was intimately familiar with most of the central characters involved in the Heritage Front and was aware of the limited role Elizabeth played. Kurt knew about my friendship with Elizabeth, and as a Facebook friend of mine, He witnessed my social interactions with her. At one point, I tried to connect them, but Elizabeth was not interested in having anything to do with Andy Weiss's Canada and did not want to share whatever personal memento she still had of her time inside the Heritage Front. Right after Elise's meeting with Elizabeth at the Madison Pub, where she shared the details of her affair with, I will not use the guy's name, but he was a very prominent member of the Canadian Jewish Congress. So right after he shared these conversations that she'd had with Elizabeth, with Kurt, I reached out to Kurt and told him of my concerns that Elizabeth may have used her intimate relations with the Canadian Jewish Congress to advance her career, including brokering a CBC film that clearly represented a majority of my lived experiences and not hers. A lot of this is really, really fascinating. I will, for a moment, digress from reading this and just summarize what Elizabeth Moore told Elise Hadigan. And she said that she'd had for several years an affair with a married senior member of the Canadian Jewish Congress, and she names him, and that he had repeatedly abused her, beaten her. And so Elise asked, as you know, what one might reasonably do, well, why did or do you let it go on? And she said, well, she felt so guilty of having been a neo-Nazi, she felt she almost deserved it. As I say, you can't make this stuff up. All of this is out in the public, and I do have to emphasize, this is an affidavit, these are sworn statements, but they have not yet been proven in court. She goes on, in December 2015, I had a falling out with Kurt over personal matters unrelated to Elizabeth or Bernie Farber. I blocked him on all social media platforms and we went our separate ways. Now, you know, there's a history here. And I have no idea as to the merits of Elise Hadigan's case. But you can see a highly emotionally unstable person. I had a disagreement with him over something that had nothing to do with politics, and so I then blocked him. Despite this fallout, all my blog posts still remained live on the Anti-Racist Canada website, and the Amazon link to my memoir, Race Traitor, was still up on the front page. All this changed in the spring of 2018 when the Canadian Anti-Hate Network was created. Now, they're another player on the scene, super bad news. They're the ones who doxed or publicized all the 250-some-odd people who signed the forms that allowed the Canadian Nationalist Party to be registered as a party. As soon as the Canadian Anti-Hate Network was created, Kurt openly described himself as a member of the advisory board in a blog detail dated May 5th, 2018, entitled "Canadian Anti-Hate Network is Now Active." You see, this is kind of significant. The crossovers. The mutual publicity between both the ARC, or Anti-Racist Canada, and the Canadian Anti-Hate Network was solidified when both Bernie Farber and Evan Balgord repeatedly requested that their own social media followers visit Anti-Racist Canada, that's Kurt Phillips' website, or Patreon page to make donations. In turn, Anti-Racist Canada solicited their own followers, follower base, to make donations to the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. Also in the months that followed the inception of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, and with full knowledge of my concerns and evidence regarding Elizabeth's behavior, Kurt began to like, retweet, and endorse Elizabeth Moore's tweets via the ARRC Collective Twitter account. You see an obsessive personality. I saw that he liked one of her tweets. Woo-hoo! Concerned about the appropriation of my story, especially on a platform I had worked for and had contributed to for years, I wrote several emails addressed to Kurt and left comments on the ARC site begging him to look at my information about Elizabeth Moore's appropriation. That's Eliza's story. A fact he was already aware of. I received no response and proceeded to tweet to ARC Collective using Kurt's real name. She outed him. On September 12, 2018, I was notified by a common friend, Daryl Lamont Jenkins, that lawyer Richard Warman had been asked by Kurt to request via Daryl that I take down the tweet I made in which I called out to Kurt Phillips. I deleted the initial tweet, but after feeling distressed that my concerns were not being addressed, namely Elizabeth Moore's misrepresentation of my lived experiences and Kurt's endorsement of her tweets on the ARC platform, I tweeted to Kurt again and wrote him one last email in which I stated I would expose their collusion if ARC endorsements of Moore did not stop. You see, I mean, you talk about fighting dirty. So I would expose, she said, I would expose their collusion. Expose who he was. Now, you need a bit of some footnotes here. Apparently, Daryl Lamont Jenkins had been asked by Richard Warman to ask her to take down the tweets that mentioned Kurt Phillips' name. Now, Daryl Lamont Jenkins is a massively obese Negro in Philadelphia who has led anti-racist anti-nationalist protests for a good many years. He apparently is a common friend of both Elise Hadigan and Richard Warman. And notice the role of Richard Warman, who, of course, has been an Ottawa operative for years, who has complained against all sorts of patriots, white nationalists, social creditors for many years, tried to get their them charged under the Section 13 of the Old Canadian Human Rights Act, which was subsequently repealed. He's been a major menace, and he is, of course, a key member of the board of directors of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. and he or she makes it clear that she will out. As I say, you can't make this stuff up. She'll out Kurt Phillips if he doesn't stop endorsing Elizabeth Moore. Instead of responding, addressing my concerns, or even explaining why he was abruptly deleting all my articles without me having the possibility of backing them up, Kurt proceeded to scrub my contributions from Anti-Racist Canada website while continuing to endorse Canadian Anti-Hate Network members on both the ARC blog and the ARC Twitter account. Kurt erased every single article I wrote for the Anti-Racist Canada between 2011 and 2015 and removed every blog post he had written in support of me and my book campaign. I believe the only thing that remains on the website are several uncredited photographs I took during Kurt's trip to Toronto, including Rosendahl's former Carlton Street home, Wolfgang Drogue's old apartment at 2 North Street, and street photos of the Heritage Front and Anti-Racist Action hangouts, such as Sneaky D's restaurant. Although I was able to recover some of my posts via the Wayback Machine, at least two articles were not, so this becomes another one of the things she holds against them for that the anti-racist cat has deleted some of her posts. And this is very significant, and now that we know who the major, who basically runs the Anti-Racist Canada website, I know there will be people who will be taking legal action. Turns out he is apparently an Alberta school teacher, and when I have that absolutely firmly confirmed, I will pass on more information. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with you tomorrow, but I'm going to go to my musical break. And we're going to play a tune that I think really summarizes what so many of us feel It's time to take our countries back, and it's time to put America first. Pearl Haggard. That's America First. I think we can all really get on board with that one. And
this Friday, see why audiences love Just Mercy.
This is a series of duets by George Jones and Pearl Haggard.
I've just got to say something here before I do anything, Merle. I've got to say what a thrill this is. To be on stage as the old Rhymer with Merle Haggard. My favorite singer since Hank Williams Sr. And I mean it with all my heart. But the main thing, we're on stage tonight for real country music. Wish I was down on some blue bayou, bamboo stuck in the sand. But the road I'm on don't seem to go. I'm just dreaming.
Sometime in my life. I'm going to do you a little medley of a Hank Williams song. If you hear one you like, you tell me about it, okay? I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. If you're a pretty thing, I do, it's just some evil scheme. Before I learned to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Somebody didn't know this next song of Hank Williams.
Here's the song that made his name famous all around our world.
Well, this is Paul Fromm back with you tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 4 in the 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, although all of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign up tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. As we wait to get the Maple Leaf Forever, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side.